You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a far ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades.
Light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds passed right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
Welcome back to The Spear. I'm Dr. Charlie Faint, your host, and I'm joined on this episode by former Sergeant Major of the Army, Dan Daly. Sergeant Major, thanks for joining us.
Well, sir, it's great to be here. You know, anytime you get an opportunity to come back to West Point and see the great work that's done here, I jump on it.
Sergeant Major, I'm excited to get into our talk about your time in Sadr City, Iraq, and the circumstances surrounding the award of your Bronze Star Medal for Valor. But first, I'd like to ask if you can share with our listeners a little bit about your Army background. You're retired now, but can you tell us about the path that led you into the Army and ultimately to Sadr City?
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in hometown America, a little small town in northeastern Pennsylvania. You know, if you get lost when you're driving around that part, you've probably run into my town. It's nothing special, but it's mine, which means it's the most special thing that I know. So I was raised by a hardworking class family. You know, my father worked very hard. My mother worked 21 years in a mill when she was raising us boys. I'm one of four boys to my family. And I was blessed. We didn't have anything. We didn't have much. We were pretty poor. But my mother gave us an incredible moral compass. She was very, very, very committed to our Catholic upbringing. And my father was a hardworking man that learned that from his father and his father before that. And I come from a long legacy of Army service, but they were all associated with war. None of them actually stayed in the Army. I was the first person that I know of in my family that spent a career at doing it. But I was inspired at a very young age because my father had served. Both my grandfathers in World War II, my great-grandfathers in World War I. My older brother had previously served in the Army before I did. And service in our household was not something that was expected, but it was something that was understood and known to be good. It'd be a good thing, a good way to start your life and a good way to give back to your community and to your country.
So did you join the Army straight out of high school?
I did. Before I ended high school, I joined the Army 11th grade. I remember I signed the contract along with my parents because I was 16 years old when I signed up for the Army. So I think I knew from a young man that that's what I wanted to do. Like I said, I came from a family didn't have a lot of financial resources. So, you know, the Army for me at that time was much. I wanted to make my family proud, live the legacy. I wanted to create opportunities and get out of that small town that I grew up in and go do bigger and better things in the world. And I wanted to go to college. And so I saw that as an avenue to all that. I never thought I was going to stay, though. Never thought I was going to stay. Yeah.
What MOS did you enlist for?
I was at 11 Mike at the time, and then transitioned to 11 Bravo. So I was 11 X-ray, actually, is what I enlisted for. And when I went to basic training, it was right before Desert. And when we got done with basic training, they said, you're going to go to AIT now, and now you're going to be 11 Mike, which I had no idea what that was. because obviously the buildup for Iraq necessitated the buildup of mechanized infantry. So I was 11 Mike for the better part of the first decade of my career.
Did you always know that you wanted Army and infantry growing up?
No. Amazing story. So I knew I wanted to serve. I actually, the Coast Guard was the first place I went. And I don't know, I used to go to the Jersey Shore with my parents on the weekend. I saw these guys. I'm like, man, you know, I hear the stories of my brother, my dad, and my grandfathers talk about, you know, the hardships of being a soldier. I said, but I could still serve and be in the Coast Guard. And I went to the Coast Guard recruiter, and it was an 18-month wait. you know, just to get looked at because so many people wanted to join the Coast Guard. So, but it wasn't hard though. I kind of always knew I was going to be a soldier. I don't think I ever would have went in the Coast Guard. I just wanted to go check it out. But then I wanted to be an aviation mechanic, a helicopter mechanic, because my passion was for aviation and engineering and aerospace. And that's what I saw myself doing when I came home. I wanted to go to college for engineering and aerospace engineering. There's a reason why my son's an aerospace engineer today. I guess he's trying to live. Well, he says I'm living his dream. You're welcome, son, by the way. And then, unfortunately, when I went to the MEP station, they discovered I had a hereditary hearing disability. And I was originally denied entry into the Army. My high school principal, who just recently passed away, was a colonel in the Army Reserves and a Vietnam veteran, and helped me apply for a waiver. And Christmas, when I was a sophomore in high school, my recruiter called me and told me the good news that the Army was going to take me. So went back to MEPS and said, all right, sign me up to be a helicopter mechanic. And they said, no. You can't hear very well, son. So here's your choices. And I said, well, I'll take infantry. And that's how it came about.
So couldn't you hear well enough to be in aviation, but certainly could hear well enough to be infantry. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. My hearing's a lot worse today, but that's as a result of my chosen profession. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't a terrible hearing disability. It was just tones, right? And obviously in the aviation field, I wouldn't have been able to pass the required test to work on aircraft. Yeah. But the Army did let me sit in the back of them for about 1,000 hours, though. That's amazing, right?
So, so what was your first duty station?
Yeah, my first duty station was Schweinfurt, Germany. Yeah, my dad was stationed in Germany. He was in the Army, and he did about 3 years. And he used to tell us all these incredible stories. Because previous to that, the only state out of South Pennsylvania I had been to in my life was New Jersey, you know, and that's where we could afford to go for summer vacation at the shore. It was an amazing time. You know, I got to fly to Germany, and I wasn't there long, though, before I had to go to the next endeavor, which was Desert Storm.
So you got there just around the time that the Berlin Wall fell then?
Just right afterwards. Yep, just right afterwards, 1990. I graduated high school, went to base training, and immediately that August I graduated from base training. And then that October, I believe, is when I landed in Schweinfurt, Germany, when the Desert Storm buildup was occurring at the time.
So what was it like to be in Europe during that time?
I was excited. I was 18 years old. You know, like I said, I hadn't been out of two states in America. You know, when I flew to Germany, that was the only third time I've ever been on an airplane, because the first and second time is when I flew to base training, when I flew home. I was an excited, enthusiastic young man that was even having been just through base training, was thankful for everything the Army was about to do for me. I really felt that way. When I got to my first unit, I knew the choice I made as a young man was the right one. I mean, and this is one of the, and I'm jumping ahead a bit, but I became successful in the Army because I was a soldier that fell into the laps of phenomenal leaders throughout my career. And not every person gets that opportunity. I did, and it started with that first duty station.
So you got there right as they were building up to the Gulf War.
Yep.
And then what was your experience after that?
Well, I deployed to the Gulf War. It ended very quickly. So actually, I deployed not as a unit. My battalion did not deploy. I deployed as a platoon out of Schweinfurt, Germany, to augment the 7th Corps main tank battle. Flew into KKMC, King Kilidad Military City Base, in preparation for what they thought was going to be a very tough fight on the ground. Spent about 3 or 4 months out there training every day in preparation to move forward. Did move forward a little bit during the offensive ground war start, and then it was over. And then we went back to Germany and trained some more. And the whole unit didn't deploy with it. It was just, like I said, it was just platoons, and that was the intent, was just to be there in case they suffered heavy casualties during the initial fight that we were there to replace them.
So I got to imagine that there was a lot of interest in going to Desert Storm.
Oh, yeah.
And it was only your platoon that went. Why do you think your platoon got picked? Do you know?
Well, it was a couple of platoons throughout the battalion.
Got it.
At the same time, we were readying reserve forces that were being shipped to Europe to be trained. So based upon what the Army had already deployed to the theater of operation, and it was quite a significant buildup, and I don't remember, there's over 900,000 in the desert, they thought, and doing what strategically they should do is preparing the next stages of war, right? So, so they already pulled as many units out of Europe as they thought they were comfortable, but I guess at the last minute they decided they needed some replacements on hand in case things got pretty rough. I mean, Saddam Hussein at the time had the fourth largest army in the world, but we just demonstrated how awesome we really were. Yeah.
So you go to Iraq, you come back to Europe, and at what rank are you now?
I'm still private. Wow. Still prepping. So that happened just in the first few months of my Army career. You know, I was just 18 when I landed in Saudi Arabia. And then I found my way pretty quickly. And I think this is all because of my first squad leader, who I consider one of the greatest leaders I've ever known in my life. And his name was Staff Sergeant Davis. He was the quintessential perfect squad leader. I mean, he trained us every day. He took us to the education center. He was disciplined, but fair and honest. He was you know, humble and he did everything that I tried to emulate for the rest of my career. And I got promoted pretty fast through the ranks as a young soldier. I was an E4 within 19 months of service, and then quickly made E5 while I was still in Germany. And then once I finished up my tour in Germany, I spent 3 consecutive years there. I PCS back to the States, and en route probably made the best decision of my life. I went back to my hometown and fell in love with my wife of 31 years of this year. Great, she listened to that. I just got in trouble. And I remember telling my father, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I just knew that this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And I didn't look back after that.
Did you know your wife prior to joining the Army?
Yes, okay. I did. She was my best friend's older sister.
Oh, you know, nice.
Grew up in my hometown, yeah.
Okay. You knew very early after all these experiences you had in the Army that you wanted to stick around for the long run. Did you ever waver in that over the years?
No. I loved what I did. I felt good about what I did. I felt passionate about it. I felt challenged and rewarded every single day. And I have to say I had a great career, and it's not just because of my single accomplishments. As I told you earlier, I got lucky. Everywhere I went, I had great leaders, and soldiers all around the world will tell you that. When you're an organization that's positive and it's got this just thriving leadership environment, you want to be part of it. And that's the experience I had throughout my entire career. I wanted to be a great leader because I was inspired by great leaders. I wanted to do more because I was inspired by those who did more before me. And my wife, I mean, gosh, coming from a small town in northeastern Pennsylvania with, you know, 5,000 people, you know, we're in heaven. Got a roof over our head. They're feeding us every day. You know, I got a meaningful mission in life that I get to exercise with the greatest gift that the American people gave you, which is their sons and daughters. And every PCS for us was not a challenge. It was a new beginning. We used to look forward to it all. And I had not an easy career either. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the field, the better part of my career in combat. And that's hard. And that is hard. And you have to have the right support from your family to be able to do that for 30 years.
For sure. At the beginning of your career, you had this experience in Iraq, and then later you went back.
Yeah.
So what did you do in between those times?
Trained. I remember doing a lot of training. Yeah. I do remember a lot of training. Those are the days where, you know, and those folks who spent time during that time in the Army were, you know, it was the train up for NTC and go to NTC. It was the train up for, you know, JRTC and go to JRTC. It was the train up for Hohenzollern and go to Hohenzollern and Grafenwehr. I do remember spending a lot of time training and leader development. You know, we had focused heavily after Desert Storm on developing future leaders, you know, advancing non-commissioned officer and officer professional development, and not just from the institutional perspective, but from the organizational perspective. And maybe I had a different experience than the others out there, but I just want everybody to recall that I grew up in organizations that had really good leaders. I mean, my battalion commander's name was Lieutenant Colonel Vince Brooks. The battalion commander next door was a guy named Lieutenant Colonel Mark Milley. You know, my battalion CSM when I was a first sergeant was a 2-time Best Ranger winner. When I say I just fell into the lucky pot, I did. And these are the people who mentored me, who I tried to emulate every day. And not everybody has that great experience, but I got to work with some of the great, and all the way to the point I was a sergeant major of the Army. I mean, my commander as a division sergeant major was General David Perkins, you know, retired as a 4-star. You know, my commander as a trade op sergeant major was General Bob Cohn. I mean, you know, my first chief was General Odierno, all legends and regarded as just incredible leaders and educators.
That's amazing. We had General Milley here in the studio a couple weeks ago. I haven't got General Brooks yet, but maybe down the road.
Did he talk about me? Did he tell you how awesome I was?
I'm sure he did, Sergeant Major.
Oh, gosh, I got to call him.
Okay, so going back to Iraq the second time, you've already been there once early in your career. When you went back for Iraq the second time, what rank were you then?
So I was a first sergeant during the initial invasion. I was in 14th Division. At that time, 3rd ID was supposed to attack from the south. 4ID was going to attack through the north through Turkey. And as history will tell you, Turkey decided they didn't want us to go through their country. All of our equipment was prepoed off the coast at the time. You know, so and then the senior leadership of the theater decided to move forward with the southern invasion. And we got a rush order to get everything off those boats and follow 3rd ID. And I was part of that that second wave. So we pushed through 3rd Infantry Division to secure the northern part of Iraq after 3rd ID made it through Baghdad.
So how much different was this experience the second time in Iraq?
Well, I was a senior leader at this point, you know, and the pace of battle by the time we're second there, it was intense. I mean, it was incredible. And I think, you know, had we continued the fight during Desert Storm, it would not have been much different. But the technology that we had enabled us to be incredibly effective and move so rapidly. And the level of intelligence and read of the battlefield was just instantaneous. It was amazing. And that was even during the invasion. You know, we were using drone systems back then that just gave us pictures that we would have dreamed of, you know, in Desert Storm, you know, from a ground perspective. And we were ready. We were. I mean, I had every bit of confidence in our platoons and their ability to fight. I mean, they were ready and well-trained and disciplined. I don't remember, you know, having any fear of them accomplishing every mission that we were going to set them out to do.
What was morale like going in for your troops? You said they were disciplined. You said they were prepared.
Oh, they were hungry. These are the guys and gals that sit around, listen to us tell Desert Storm stories for 10 years and didn't go to war. You know, it's kind of, when I first joined the Army, there were still very small remnants of Vietnam veterans still in the war. Brigade commanders, senior battalion commanders, sergeant majors. You know, we're Vietnam vets, but, you know, and I don't want to sound like we're warmongers or anything like that, but there's a pride in defending your nation, and that pride runs very strong in combat arms formations, and they were hungry, and we know why too, from a national perspective on what had happened to our country as leading up to the factors of why we were there in the first place. I've spoke on this many times. There's a misconception, I think, by some of the public that leaders in the Army have to motivate and coach soldiers in the heat of combat. I'd never experienced that. Exactly the opposite. It was like my job was there to hold them back. Hold on. Let's And never, ever, ever did I ever have a soldier not want to move forward, even in the most dangerous situations. They just do it. They want to fight and win.
How long was that deployment?
That was 12 months. Yeah, this is before we got into the extensions, actually, because, you know, we thought we were going to secure Iraq and leave. And then they said, hey, you're staying here 12 months. That was a little shocking at first to the soldiers. You know, I was one of the guys that's got to drive around and tell the young men and women that, hey, you know what? We're going to be here a while, you know, and I don't think any of us knew that initially, but there was really no acceptance. I mean, the toughest thing at that point was, from a leadership perspective, was we went 65 days without a shower during the invasion. I mean, we went 65 days without eating nothing but MREs, and I'm not weighing that against anybody's time of being in that situation, but if you're going to be there for a year, we have to start some type of sustainability for our men and women, right?
That's so right.
That was the kind of slow coming thing. You know, we had everything we needed to fight and win an attack, but we didn't come up with KBR and big chow halls till much later, right? So I remember spending several months after that, the initial calm of the storm, because, you know, it grew up after that. And we all know the history of Iraq, of trying to figure out how we were going to take care of them. You know, from a sustainment standpoint.
Mm-hmm. So what was your area of responsibility when you were over there? Where were you operating in Iraq?
We pushed past 3rd ID in Baghdad. And then initially I was in Balad.
Okay.
And but we moved all the way north to the Hammer Mountains. I was part of the organization that disarmed the MEK. Mm. I don't know if you've heard of that. And gosh, I feel terrible because I hate saying acronyms on podcasts. But they were kind of love-hated by Saddam on the border of Iran. And they were a pretty good fighting force, you know. And so, yeah, we started in Baghdad, fought up to Saddam's hometown. And then ended up coming back just south of Balad and working in an area called Southern Saladin Province. And so that's where we kind of stayed for a while, based out of Balad Air Base before it was grown up to this big logistics. It became a logistics hub.
I mean, sure did.
The logistics hub. Now, this is when we're the ones who attacked it, you know, took it really from all the looters who were stealing stuff from it at that time. And then fighting the knife fight of, you know, all the attacks that were happening on every day. So Southern Saladin Province is where we kind of made a base camp.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So this wasn't your only time in OAIF, though?
No, that was just the first tour. I did three consecutive tours after that. So wow. Four back-to-back tours.
Wow, as an 11 Bravo?
As an 11 Bravo, yes, sir.
Amazing. So what was it like going back time and again with different troops? Was there ever any sense of why are we doing this?
No. So I came back from that first tour and got selected for Sergeant Major. And just so happens that when I graduated, I was supposed to be going to the 82nd Airborne, but I got sent back to the same battalion I was the first sergeant in. And literally deployed back to Iraq again with the same battalion as the battalion CSM.
Wow.
To the exact same area that we were the year previous. So same headquarters, actually. The unit that relieved us, we relieved them. And then that's when it started getting hectic. That's when we saw the uprising between the Sunni and the Shia. You know, we were very close to an internal civil war. We saw huge non-state actors from other countries coming in and doing harm's way by our soldiers from, you know, you name your acronym of people at the time. So very dangerous. And so we had to heavily invest in changing the training mindset of our soldiers from high intensity conflict to what were now COIN operations, you know, counterinsurgency operations, because that's really what we were dealing with at that time. Yeah.
So what year was this?
Okay, first tour was 2004. That would be 5-6.
Got it.
Yeah, 5-6. Okay. 2005, 2006.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So when did you start going into Sauter City? That's the thing we're going to talk about the most about today. That was a pretty hot place to be.
That was my third tour. That was my third tour, so with 4th Infantry, fourth tour in Iraq, including Desert Storm, but third tour during OIF. So we had, we'd come back from that second tour, retrained, and actually we were, based upon the patch schedule, and we had been extended during the second tour to 15 months. We were initially going to go to Afghanistan, but we didn't. We got switched back to Iraq. But in order to make that time, we had a limited time at home to train. I think we only had about 11 months back on station. I had been promoted to the brigade sergeant major of that same brigade I was in, 3rd Brigade Combat Team, 4th Infantry Division. And we relieved a brigade from the 82nd Airborne in Baghdad. And during the time of Riptoa, we were starting to see some gains in stabilization within the city. But the Jaish al-Mahdi, who lived in a place called Sauter City, weren't going to have that. So they started causing some huge disruption in the city shortly after we Riptoa'd. Now, when we went there, we took all of our heavy mechanized equipment. So obviously, I just said we replaced a light infantry unit out of the 82nd Airborne Division. But we stationed all that stuff up at Taji, thinking that we weren't going to need it, right? But we brought it. And so we were basically using up armored Humvees and MRAPs to patrol within the city. And then that's when they started firing rockets into the green zone.
So we had Muqtada al-Sadr, who was in charge of the Mahdi militia, the Jaish al-Mahdi, down there. And you talked about love-hate relationships. It seems like the United States had a kind of a love-hate relationship with Muqtada al-Sadr as
sure
well.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I don't know if it was anything but an informal agreement, but nobody had been in Sauter City from an operational perspective since several tours previous when 1st Cav went in there and got into a pretty serious firefight and took a loss of some combat power. And that gave the Muqtada al-Sadr and his followers the opportunity to have a very significant buildup in combat capability. We knew that a lot of the EFPs that were happening in and around Baghdad at the time were coming out of factories within Sauter City. We later subsequently found those. And not to try to be too far ahead in the story. And we know that he was being backed by Iran because we at that time, intelligence was telling us he was freely traveling back and forth between Iran. And we had pretty significant evidence that Iranian operatives were working within and around Sauter City. The other problem, too, was how they had taken financial control, because within Sauter City, which is the eastern side of Baghdad proper, it's the most densely populated area of Baghdad, but it also has one of the largest markets in Baghdad. And they were controlling that from a financial perspective and gaining a lot of financial resources as a result of their control. They're basically the informal government, you know, in Sauter City, and lived with a reign of fear, to be very honest with you. You know, the people who are hardworking, a lot of good hardworking people within Sauter City, you know, when you have a faction like that that's in charge, they're just going to do what they have to do to survive.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
You said you brought your heavy equipment to Iraq, but you left it up in Taji. when you started doing operations down in Sadr City, did you end up bringing that back down?
Yeah, immediately.
Yeah.
So when we finally got the word, obviously it was a little buildup there. It was a month or two that they're starting to fire heavily, rockets heavily into the green zone. Initially, we were using drones and aviation to help counter that. Of course, you know, the enemy gets pretty savvy. You know, they start firing from inside buildings, so it's a little bit different. And then the decision was made for us to do an all-out assault. Again, people had not been in there for years, and we knew that the EFP threat alone was going to be pretty significant. So Measley dispatched the soldiers up to Taji, drew out our tanks and Bradleys and Strikers, and we went heavy in.
Nice. Mm-hmm. I was in Iraq as well during that time period. I was an intel officer. I was with 5th Special Forces Group. So mm-hmm. we were looking hard at Muqtada al-Sadr for a long time, trying to get that guy. And then he came off the target deck. Yeah. And it was a very interesting situation. Yeah. But before that happened, we had a couple of big battles down in Sadr City. So can you talk to us about what it was like to do patrols in a place that's that heavily populated and that angry?
Yeah, absolutely. It's extremely difficult. So I think someone had said it was the largest army combat fight since World War II, actually. Mm. I mean, the density of population per household, I think, was 35 to 40 per building. And initially, we had a plan to go in, punch to the center of Sadr City, stop at a halfway point, build a separation between Mukhtar al-Sadr's forces, Jaish al-Mahdi, and us, and then start clearing house to house. I mean, and I'll tell you, when you train as an infantry soldier, special operations, you know, you hear always hear it takes a platoon to take a house and a company to take a block. And oh no, it takes a whole lot more than that. I mean, it takes a lot of forces, not to take planes, but to hold them.
Sure.
Right? So, and but our team did a great job. The soldiers in 3rd Brigade and the 2 ACR that were attached to us just executed the plan. You know, of course, it was a knife fight every day with EFPs, soldiers, Jaish al-Mahdi taking, who could blend in with the population, taking shots at us. But during the what I call the initial invasion into, and that's probably not the right term to use, our young men and women established quick control. Nice. And it was kind of almost came to a shock. I think there was a buildup of us not being in there so long that the enemy thought, they're never going to come in here. As a matter of fact, the night before we invaded, a Jaish al-Mahdi guy came to our headquarters asking if he could talk to us and told me and my brigade commander to our faces, it'll take us 1,000 years to get them out of Sadr City.
Wow. That's bold.
And then we said, well, we'll see you tomorrow morning. Literally, that's what we said to him. We'll see you tomorrow morning. I mean, we told him. They knew we were coming, right? So there was no hiding that. And 3 months later, you know, we ended up chasing them out of there. But the bravery was amazing. We sustained the loss of 2 soldiers during that 3-month battle. Fired enough hellfires, I think, to empty out the country stock several times. The amount of munitions from M1, 30 Mike, 40 Mike out of Apaches was just incredible. But to watch the soldiers perform in the way they did was just absolutely, the commanders on the ground, platoon leaders, platoon sergeants, the individual soldiers. I know there's battles throughout history that lost longer than that, but this there was no relief. There was no pull. It was day-to-day fighting in around that city while the population existed within the city. That's the difficult part, you know, and trying to keep things running, you know, keep the market going, doing all those things to help build a campaign against the enemy. And so you asked a specific question, what it was like. You felt like you had a crosshair on you every day. And there were several times where, unfortunately, that's what caused us the most havoc after the initial assault into Sadr City was when we were trying to do sustained operations was it was a target-rich environment for the enemy. It was, and it was difficult.
So did you see or did you enact any type of, like, novel TTPs in order to help you with this operation that we don't get to practice at scale?
Outside of combat. All kinds of things. So, you know, when we breached, you would have got a zero at the National Training Center for our breaching methods. I mean, so you got to imagine, I think we hit, you know, 190 EFPs during the fight, if my last recall, during the initial punch down the center of Sadr City on Route Gold. You know, our lead vehicle took 5 EFPs, and we learned that canister rounds from an M1 tank do very well against explosive form projectiles and IEDs within a city. Obviously, that's not the deliberate way to do it when you're trying to sustain operations within an operating city, but when the enemy has thrown every bit of explosives at you, it works. It's effective. People will say that tanks and Bradleys are not effective within an urban fight. If properly utilized, they are. Our biggest friend was aviation assets and keeping them what we called, we went back to, and actually it was one of our chief warrant officers that were flying with the Gambler guns. That's who was supporting us. I got to give them credit because they save my soldiers' lives every day. The Gambler guns out of the 4th Infantry Division's attack aviation element. One of the chiefs said, hey, listen, they made a change in Vietnam when the enemy got really good at using counter-aircraft weapon systems. So they executed what was called high-altitude support. So I could get direct and indirect fire, missile fire from an Apache 24/7. We had four flying continuously. We used a baseball field. That's how basic we said. We got home plate, first base, second base, third base, and we would call a target out, and that's how they would identify it. And you couldn't hear the Apache. You couldn't see it, but the enemy knew they were there. I mean, obviously. And they just exercised the engagement criteria that we set up was just well executed by the entire combined arms team. I mean, in the Air Force with their armed drones, our attack aviation element, our ground forces, all had a very common understanding of how to mutually support and grow fires in a specific area if needed. So it was very well done. And I mean, just very well executed by the entire combined arms team. And we had learned a lot of lessons from the two previous urban fights, too, out in, you know, in the West. I mean, so, and I think that we did an awesome job of using all the assets we had. And thanks to the senior leadership of the Army at the time and MMCI, they gave us all the assets we needed.
So you mentioned EFPs, the explosively formed projectiles mm-hmm. that Iran was introducing in to support not only the Shia militias, but mm-hmm. just about everybody else yeah. that was in there. So can you talk about the effect that something like that has on an armored vehicle?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it accounts for most of our combat loss, not just from a human, but a vehicle perspective. I've seen explosively formed projectiles go through, you know, 8 to 12 inches of reinforced concrete and then through the side of our up-armored vehicles. In the early parts of the battle, we know that one of our M1 Abrams tanks was hit with the new RPG-19 that we know was given to the Jaish al-Mahdi to test for, you know, nations like Russia and Syria and those folks. Let's just say this, it created devastating damage to the okay. to those platforms. Because that is the same thing as a flying explosively formed projectile, the RPG-19. Very, very crudely made, easily sourced, a very effective weapon system. You know, that was developed, I think, by the Germans back in the 20s or 30s. And it's very hard to combat. Because you could literally hide them behind hard structures. They'll go through those hard structures and through the combat vehicles. So,
wow.
And I think the sky's the limit on, you know, it's the size, the shape of the projectile, and how much force you put behind it. I mean, I'm sure you could put, you know, 2 feet of homogeneous rolled steel together, and you could still find the EFP that would go through it. Yeah. And you can't use a vehicle that's heavy.
I mean, right.
That's too heavy to drive around.
Right.
So, yeah, yeah. There wasn't anything that we had on the battlefield that an EFP wouldn't go through. So what you have to do is focus on how detection and determine. And then eventually we found one of the factories within Sadr City. But there was a stockpile of them that we found one day that they had plenty. They had plenty to use.
So what was the ultimate outcome of that attack in the Sadr City? You said you took it in 3 months?
Yeah. Yeah, we wore down the enemy, depleted the resources. We had intelligence reads that the leadership went back to Iran. War is a conflict of wills between two people. And as soon as you break one, you win. And that's literally what we did. But simultaneously, we had to win the will of the people living there. Now, we just fought a war on their doorstep, the most densely populated portion of Baghdad. And every day while doing that, we kept reiterating to the soldiers, listen, we have to build trust with the people that live here, or they're going to fight us too. Or they're just going to join the insurgency, right? And there was a huge campaign after we stabilized the area to do just that. We found a pool in Sadr City and rebuilt it, and kids were swimming in it like a month later. You know, stores, anything we could, rebuilt the market, anything we can do to get it back to business. And the enemy was fighting us. I mean, they were blowing up the water supply. We'd have to go back out there and immediately get it fixed, because if you got a city with that many people in it and it's the summertime and they don't have no water, well, they're going to go out there and shoot at you. That's
right,
what they're going to do.
Right.
I mean, so there was a huge, from the State Department, from the senior leadership that were in the theater at the time, huge push to give us all the resources we needed to help build the will of the people. And I think a combination between the overwhelming firepower that we, and I'm going to say this not because I thought I did it, but gloriously put together by the team that we had and executed, and the fact that they weren't going to win the fight against the people, and we were winning the fight to build the trust and confidence behind them. They gave up. They just gave up, and they knew it was a no-win fight. They just knew it.
Explosive devices, especially EFPs, can be terrifying and frustrating weapons yeah. when they're being used against you. So how did you and your team manage that, the fear of that unknown yeah. and the damage that it can inflict?
Very strict guidance put out. Yeah, I talked about this. What are some of the training things? Is, you know, if anybody said, hey, I need a ride somewhere, and if it was just a few miles down the road, it was going to take a couple hours. I mean, everything was a deliberate movement operation. Everything. Anything that was on the side of the road, anything that looked out of the ordinary. We had route clearances going through several hours every day, and we would quickly degrade that route based upon how long it had been there. And we wouldn't let people move down those routes until we sent deliberate clearing operations back down there to check them and clear them. We had to learn the enemy's TTPs. We had to learn their methods. And they're always going to come out with new ones. But once you understand the psyche of what they're doing and soldiers really grasp that and absorb it, they can start identifying the indicators of something's not right. Right. And it takes an entire campaign from the lowest private to the highest ranking person in the organization. If you're in a rush to get somewhere, you're going to get somebody killed.
That's right.
That's right. If you're in a rush to do something that you know is not, you're going to get somebody killed. And unnecessarily, there's a reality of war that people are going to get hurt. But we couldn't be in a rush to do anything. Everything had to be a deliberate movement operation just because of that one enemy threat. And we ingrained that down the individual soldier. And I think that learning those TTPs is what saved a lot of our soldiers' lives.
So you're a brigade sergeant major this time, mm-hmm. and you mentioned a couple of times now about the need to win over the people. Did you and your brigade commander do any engagements?
Every day.
Okay.
Literally, we all had a patrol schedule. I had my own patrol schedule, but the brigade commander, we were not talk commander, sergeant major. During that entire battle, we were on the battlefield every single day. If I wasn't directly contributing to the battlefield, I was personally doing casualty back. I mean, as the brigade sergeant major, that was a combat asset. I had four vehicles with a whole security team.
Right.
I mean, if a striker element needed reinforcing fires, as the brigade sergeant major, I would wow. move my vehicles over there and take my 450 cals and start rocking, right? So, and my soldiers had to be trained to do that every day. So there was no, hey, you know, but we're also, you know, the leaders of the organization too, making sure that things are done. But it's not just Sauter City, it's any situation. Your presence is the most important leadership thing you can provide. And they knew that we were out there. I mean, I had company commanders calling the brigade sergeant, hey, I need your help. Or, hey, can you pull this guy out for me? You know, and my guys and myself are running to pull this casualty back. And when you build that kind of understanding that, hey, you're out there with no fight, they trust you, and it just enables them to be able to go do what they can do because they know someone's going to be back there to back them up, right? So, and, you know, you don't want to be an asset consumer. You want to be an asset to the organization. Yeah. If I got four combat vehicles dedicated to me with soldiers who are heavily trained, then I should be out there fighting, not just driving around and shaking hands.
That's right. That's right. Right. Especially at the junior leader ranks, officer and NCO, we teach lead from the front. Mm-hmm. But being at the physical front isn't always the best place for a leader to be. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question. It's, you know, what's the best place for me to be? Well, it's the best. It's the place to control the battle. If that needs to be the front, then that needs to be the front. That's probably not always the case. For the commander, it's where you can gain the most situational awareness. Right, that's how you keep your soldiers alive. I firmly believe that after five tours in combat. For the sergeant major, it's best how you can support your commander in that mission or support your subordinate organizations in what they're doing, right? How do you enable them? I quickly learned in the beginning of Sauter City is that, hey, I can come up there and fight my way to the front to get a casualty and get them so I can keep that commander and his soldiers back in the fight. Or I can come up there when need be, when there's, you know, two strikers, three strikers that are trying to hold, you know, an area much larger than what a platoon should really be holding, and provide them some reinforcing fires, right? Because I have four very capable combat platforms and I'm driving around burning diesel in all day. You might as well make them effective, right? So I think it's also fluid. The one place on the battlefield is not going to be the right place in any given situation. It really depends on the battle and your ability to read it. But I think primarily for our commanders out there is what's the best operational position to get the read on the battlefield for you?
Well, somewhere in all this, something happened that resulted in you receiving the Bronze Star Medal for Valor. Can we go into that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. It was really for a culmination of all the events that happened during the Battle of Sauter City. I think one special thing probably triggered the decision by leaders to do that, but it wasn't specific to that one event. So I'll kind of explain. So I was out on the battlefield every single day just doing my job. You know, none of us are looking for accolades or awards. We had taken pretty good portion of our initial phase line gold, secured pretty good portion of that. And I was on the northeastern side of just short of phase line gold, which was where our limit advance was at the time, out there with one of our striker units. And our division commander came out there with his PSD. I think the enemy had a read on that. The reason why I know that to be true is because he was using up-armor Humvees, but we wouldn't allow up-armor Humvees within the confines of Sadr City, because at this time we needed the combat vehicles that were capable to provide the maximum amount of defense against EFPs, which was our number one threat.
Okay.
And so the enemy knew there was something different, and they mashed pretty quickly. When the division commander got out on the ground with myself and the company commander, striker company commander, we took on a pretty significant barrage of enemy fire initiated with an RPG that flew above myself and the division commander's head by about 6 inches and hit the wall behind us. And so I spent about 45 minutes to an hour fighting our way out of there that day and making sure the strikers were in place. And I think that's what triggered the decision, by because the division commander is the one that put me in and approved my Bronze Star for Valor. But I think it was an indication of him of what we were doing down there every single day inside that fight. It wasn't just like for that one specific incident, but the realization of, man, this guy's down here getting after it every day. Not just me. My soldiers are getting after it every day. So I just can't stress how much I benefited from having great soldiers, great leaders. You know, to lose two soldiers in that much combat in 3 months is still to this day is an unfortunate, and the loss of any soldier is too much, right? But it was amazing the amount of contact that we sustained in that short period of time. And I attribute to the leaders of the organization that we had very, very, very minimal loss, because there was plenty of opportunity for the enemy to be able to gain more loss than that. But we just had an incredible, homogeneous, hardworking unit.
Let's unpack that a little bit more. What do you ascribe that to? Because it's not like you're holed up on a FOB. You're out there. All your troops getting after it every day. Yeah. There are people actively trying to get after you with the best stuff that the enemy can throw at you. And any casualty is tragic, but to only have two is interesting. What do you think? Why do you think that was?
I think we better from a thing, home station training. I know it's going to sound very cliche-ish, but it's true. Home station training. And the preponderance of my senior NCOs and officers in that brigade at that time had already had a lot of time in Iraq. Mm,
okay.
They were war educated. I mean, and although we had to adapt every day to the enemy, I mean, it wasn't their first rodeo. So they had been doing this for most of them for two previous tours. And again, we were blessed with just great leaders who really cared about what they were doing and then had the ability to synchronize that together. I mean, I remember our company commanders at the time. They were like brothers, our first sergeants, like brothers, the battalion sergeant majors, brothers and sisters. I mean, they were really good unit that worked closely together. And it was just great to see them operate, you know, as an entire brigade. And then the amount of support we received from strategic level assets from echelons above corps. If my commander asked for it, we got it.
Nice.
Which was really good. I mean, from special operations capabilities and support to intelligence to strategic level assets. We really felt like we were being supported. And at that time, and probably because Muqtada Sadr and the Jaish al-Mahdi kind of took the gloves off for the Americans, at that time, we were unencumbered by any political view. And I'm not one to get into politics, but we know that that's a factor, right?
Sure.
I always said, you know, even when I was sergeant of the Army, I am apolitical, but I have to realize I work in a political environment, right? And at any war, there's always politics that are involved in that. But at that period, it was, what do you need? And let's execute. It felt kind of good to really, as a commander and sergeant major, to exercise the full capability of your brigade. It was awesome. It was awesome. It was like, gloves are off. Go ahead, gentlemen. Do what you get paid to do as an American soldier. It was really comforting because we knew we weren't limited by anything, and that was going to protect our soldiers.
One of the enduring symbols of the war in Iraq is the T-wall. In fact, when I was over there, one of the gifts they give people was mini T-walls as you're going home. So I heard that one of the things that really helped out in Sadr City was ultimately you all dropped a line of T-walls down the middle of the city.
We built the Golden Wall. That's right. Yeah. So when I said so our initial assault is we intended to go halfway through Sadr City, right? And then we called it Route Gold. Okay. That was our phase line that we were going to end at and initially it was going to go on beyond that, right? So we were literally going to wall them off because within Route Gold, the space that we were going to occupy was the major market. That was the epicenter of feeding the people in Baghdad, right? So we knew we had to get past that. That would do two things. One, so we could sustain the market and keep the people happy. Two, take the financial resources away from the enemy. Because we knew if we just go in there and blow up the city, which we could have done. I mean, we had the combat power just go in there and destroy everything. We could have, right? What good is that going to do? The people are going to get upset with us. It's not going to create any economic stability. How are we going to rebuild the country?
Yeah.
So we got to do this with precision. So we had to go in there with a knife, slice it down the center. That wall was built by a soldier with a ladder and a crane in direct fire contact.
Wow.
I have, if anybody's ever seen it, I have it. It's in my living room. It's called The Tipping Point, The Battle for Sadr City. And one of the main features when they're behind all the explosions and the Bradleys and tanks and the Apaches is the soldier hanging, unhooking the two hooks from the T-wall. And they were engaged with 50 caliber sniper rifles. And the snipers shot out the cables a few times on the crane. I mean, we're talking now, not all day, every day, but that the worst part is knowing sometimes you can feel it. Only a seasoned soldier who know, hey, something's bad is about to happen. And then all of a sudden all heck breaks loose, right?
Right.
And then obviously it would calm down. And then all of a sudden that's the worst part of it is being ready for it to happen any moment. Yeah, that was a logistics feat in itself. I mean, we were shipping those things from across the city on low boys into a direct fire engagement area, unloading them by hand with soldiers while you're being surrounded by, the estimates were 14,000 JSA
money. Wow.
And at any given day, we only had 900 to 1,000 soldiers on the ground. That's what we were outnumbered, 15 to 1. But our soldiers still prevail.
5 combat tours total in all your time there. Mm-hmm. Did you go to Afghanistan as well?
Not stationed. Okay. Several visits, obviously, as a senior leader, sergeant major, and when I was a division CSM, but not stationed there. Yeah.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
At some point, you rose through the ranks and you were evaluated and eventually chosen to be the sergeant major of the Army, which is the top enlisted position in the U.S. Army. I'm familiar with it, but I know a lot of our listeners won't be. Yeah. Can you explain what that job entails?
Yeah, that's a great question. Especially people not in the Army or the military would ask me all the time, what is the sergeant major of the Army? the easiest way I could explain it from a civilian perspective is you have the COO, the chief operating officer, and that would be the secretary. The CEO is the chief, the senior general officer. And you're kind of like the general manager, the GM. So the vice and I, which is the vice chief of staff in the Army, used to always say, we get to do everything the chief and secretary don't want to do. But that was my job. My job was to manage a listed force. Most people don't know that. But, I mean, that was a day-to-day with the G1 and the folks, manage a list of force, oversight of the non-commissioned officer education system, because in our Army, like no other in the world, is completely run by the enlisted population. And then managing, the balance of MOSs within the Army. But also, one of the more important things is being the eyes and ears of the chief and the secretary, and using that to communicate to internally to the Army, externally to America, and to our elected officials. During my tenure as a sergeant major of the Army, I spent more time on the Hill than the chief and the secretary combined. I mean, and established personal relationships with them to get things done and to communicate things to the members of primarily the HASC and SAS, right? One, to keep them informed about major changes that we were doing at that time. We were implementing females into combat arms and changing a lot of significant programs that were never the Army's decisions. Those were all laws, by the way. And keeping our elected leaders informed and building a trust relationship with them is very beneficial to both parties, right? So, and you have to do that over time, and it's critically important, I think. And they get a better picture of what the military wants and needs, and they also feel comfortable that that is in fact the true wants and needs of our military and the service members that fight for it.
So you mentioned the HASC and the SASC, the Senate Armed Services Committee and the House Armed Services Committee. Thinking back to your time as a young private coming out of Pennsylvania and Germany, all the times in Iraq, did you ever think that you would see yourself in that situation?
Oh, no. I always said I just wanted to be a soldier. I would have never fathomed that. I mean, it didn't even dawn on me until I was the Trade Ox Army Major running the Army's Training and Doctrine Enterprise, and that's really running the enlisted education program for the Army, and the chief in the SMA at the time. When my commander, Bob Cohn, looked at me and goes, hey, I'm putting your name in to be the Sergeant Major of the Army. I'm like, oh, my God, this is real. And then people ask me, you know, what's it like? And I say, you know, you go through this whole selection process and, you know, background investigations and boards and, you know, interviews and all those things. And then finally you walk in the chief's office and when you're down to, like, the final four or five, and he looks at you and says, hey, you're going to be the Sergeant Major of the Army. And there's a little bit of excitement. That should be every soldier's dream. I believe that. I mean, that's every soldier should have the feeling that they could, one, do it, and two, achieve it if they really wanted it. And then immediately after that microsecond of happiness is this overwhelming fear. It's like, wait a minute. Oh, my God, I'm the Sergeant Major of the Army now. I need to grow up, you know. And, yeah, and you already have, you know, how many years in the military and several combat tours, and people say, well, how could it possibly be that way? I said, well, you got to understand something. Everything I say and do from that point not only affects Dan Daly and his family, but now a family of 1.2 million people. And wow. It's a pretty important job. I mean, because it does have a big impact on the Hill, and it has a big impact on morale down internally. And the Sergeant of the Armies can influence those things and have a very positive or negative influence, right, based upon his or her own actions.
Well, did you get any good advice before you took the job?
Yes, I did. I did. Two pieces of advice. The first one was, hey, Dan, don't get fired. And the second one is because that's not – some people say, oh, I try to get fired every day. Well, that's what I'm talking about. Getting fired as the SMA is not good for the Army, right? Period. It's not. The second one is the Army is sometimes chaotic, and it operates okay being chaos. Your job is not to fix chaos. Mm. Your job is to control it. Mm. That was probably the best piece of advice I got. You are not going to go in there. The Army is this huge monster, right? It's just, and that's some of the best things about it, right? Is that we somehow thrive in the most chaotic situations in the United States Army. And our soldiers and commanders do best on the battlefield in the absence of all orders, right? And that's why the enemy can't figure us out, right? They're like, what the heck? And that was some of the best advice I got. Your job is not to end chaos, it's to manage it. If you try to and chaos, you're going to be biting off way more than you can chew, which was great advice. But I also like the one, don't get fired, too. That was pretty good advice.
I think that's good advice for any job. Don't get fired. Always good. Well, yeah. Sergeant Major, I know that we only have a couple minutes left with you before you got to roll off to your next engagement here at West Point. But I did want to talk to you briefly about the officer and CO relationship at West Point, and certainly for me in ROTC. That was one of my biggest concerns as a young officer. How do I manage that relationship? What kind of advice do you have for young leaders?
This is something I am extremely passionate about, and is why I spend so much time with ROTC and West Point today. Because I took this as the American non-commissioned officer should, as they own this. This is their responsibility. And this is what makes it different from any other army in the world. Most armies that I worked with throughout my career can't understand why a seasoned sergeant first class, but at the time I got my first lieutenant, I already had several tours in combat. You know, I was a ranger, I was a master gunner, I was master fitness, you know, all these schools and education will immediately subordinate themselves and put on a pedestal this brand new second lieutenant who just comes out of college. And this is what I used to communicate to my NCOs. This relationship is so important because the Army's the Army, but really the Army's in platoons. That's where it's at. That's who fights the wars, platoons, companies, and squads. And that relationship is so important and is bigger than those two people. And that's what those two people have to realize is I don't care who you are or where you're from or what you think about your platoon leader or what the platoon sergeant thinks about him or her and he or her thinks about him or her. That relationship should be seamless for those people that you lead because that's what it's all about, right? Now, the good news is my first platoon leader is awesome. And before we came on the show today, I call him literally every week to this day. I'm retired. He's still a very senior officer in the Army today, and I'll give him credit, Lieutenant Anha. My job was to make sure that, one, he was trained and ready to fight and win that platoon, and that the men and women of that platoon, well, the men at the time, because we were just infantry and there was no women at that time, so had the confidence that he could do that. And that was my personal responsibility. And if anything other than that occurred, it was my personal failure. That was my job. And also subordinate myself to him to make sure that the soldiers knew that he was the platoon leader, not me. And I think that the platoon sergeants out there that do a good job at that create the best officers in the world.
I agree.
They create the best officers in the world. That can give them their knowledge, skill, and attribute, subordinate their authority, and build the trust and confidence from the individual soldier up to that platoon leader. Those platoon leaders go on to be super, super successful. And that's what we get paid to do. That's a job that we have at hand. It's a responsibility that I took very, very personally. And then when I was a first sergeant, I took very personally with my platoon sergeants. You know, I ingrained to them, listen, your job is to support your platoon leader. And same when I became battalion sergeant major. And a single lieutenant did not come into my battalion without, obviously, battalion commander gets first dibs, right? So he's the boss. He's the boss.
Right.
But they and he would tell them, the first person you're going to go see is a battalion sergeant major. And our battalion sergeant major is going to walk you down to your new company.
Nice.
And I'm going to introduce you to the commander and first sergeant. And then I'm going to go talk to the platoon sergeant, you know, and charge him with, you know, the responsibility that I felt I had when I was a sergeant first class. So I think it is so critical, and not for the benefit of either of those people, but for the soldiers they lead. And the soldiers need to see nothing but a seamless, homogeneous organization at that level, because it's the most critical. That's where we retain soldiers in platoon, in companies. Soldiers have no idea. Most soldiers in their first term that serve 3 or 4 years may never even see the brigade commander, right? I mean, to them, that's just the big army guys, you know, that send down these orders. That's it, you know.
Right, unless he's up front of the brigade run or something like that.
That's right. We re-enlist soldiers because of their squad leaders, the platoon leaders, the platoon sergeants, the first sergeant, company commander. Anything above that, it's just like, to them, it's like another world. You know, that's like Amazon headquarters. You know, that's like and that's why that relationship is so important at that level, because we want soldiers to have a positive aspect of, hey, I want to be able to, I want to do that someday. That's what I want to do. That's why I re-enlisted. I looked at those men at the time and said, that's what I want to be. That's the platoon sergeant I want to be. You know, that's the first sergeant I want to be. That's the battalion sergeant major I want to be. And I always felt it was my responsibility to support my commander and be an enabler for them so they could accomplish the mission, or we could accomplish the mission.
Sergeant Major, last question. I'm sure your escort's already outside pacing because we're running a little late here. But I didn't want to let this last question go. So the spear is a story about the combat experience, but at the end of the day, any story about combat is a story about leadership.
Yeah.
So what words of advice would you offer to young leaders of any rank who are looking to either join the Army or continue in the service?
Yeah. I would say is there's an opportunity for everybody in our great Army. There is. And I also say that we need not to forget to communicate that to every young man and woman in this nation. Not everyone is going to choose to serve, and that's fine. I don't believe that you have to wear a uniform to serve this great nation. There's many ways to do that. If we create ignorance in the next generation by not giving them the information, we're going to have a problem. And there is some areas in this country that refuse to talk about the next generation about service. We're going to have an army, and the army's not going to decide how we build it. It's the American people that are going to decide, right? So I think it's important that we tell these stories. I think it's the important we tell – and the truth, right? This is not easy life. It's there's challenges to being in the military. That's not a secret. But if we don't at least educate the next generation on the service and sacrifice of those who had served previously and the opportunities that could be before them, you know, we're going to have to continue to have a challenge in this nation to recruit and retain the best that are absolutely necessary to defend our way of life.
Sergeant Major, I think that's a great place to leave it. Thank you so much for your time. And on behalf of my boss, Colonel Pat Sullivan, I really appreciate you being here today and sharing your time with us, and look forward to doing it again.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.